The following message is by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
Well, we enter into one of the most interesting books of our Bible. And it's interesting because so many people don't know what to do with it. Does it fit in Scripture? How should we understand it? I included a quotation. I'll add another in a little bit, but Old Testament scholar James Crenshaw, who happened to have gotten his MDiv at Southern Seminary ancient days ago, and then he gave up all evangelicalism, and he's as flaming of a liberal as you will find, but he says, "Life is profitless, totally absurd. This oppressive message lies at the heart of the Bible's strangest book. Enjoy life if you can, advises the author, for old age will soon overtake you. And even as you enjoy, know that the world is just meaningless. Virtue does not bring reward. The deity stands distant, abandoning humanity to chance and death. These views contrast radically with earlier teachings expressed in the book of Proverbs." Is that how we should think about this book? Tremper Longman, conservative evangelical scholar, former professor at Westminster, and now retired research professor at school in California. Really pretty spot. Santa Barbara, that's where he, what school's in Santa Barbara? Westmont. So he's a retired research professor at Westmont College. He is a true dear brother, but he believes that most of Ecclesiastes is the body of it, that is the voice of Koheleth, the preacher in Ecclesiastes. He is the voice that we hear in verses 1, in chapter 1, verse 2, all the way up through chapter 12, verse 8. This lesson that he supplies is more like the wisdom of Job's three friends than of Job, and that we are actually supposed to reject it all rather than embrace it all. So is he a foolish sage, Koheleth? Or is he a godly sage and a realist who's actually saying true things that are honoring to God and that ultimately will build hope in the Messiah? How are we to understand this book? And I remember in my former position, probably about a decade ago now, a very well-known pastor, John Piper, was on a John Piper Ask Pastor John podcast, and someone said, the preacher in Ecclesiastes says X, and what are we to do with that? And Pastor John's first response was, well, you have to understand that the preacher in Ecclesiastes is not orthodox. And then he went on to respond. But then when pressed by certain faculty members at Bethlehem, or maybe a faculty member, at Bethlehem College and Seminary, he admitted that, well, honestly, it's the book in all the Bible that I know least about. And I can't put it all together yet, and I just haven't given time to it. Kevin DeYoung, preached 8 or 9 messages on the book. How many of you have listened to his sermons on Ecclesiastes? Anybody? We've got 1 and maybe some. Okay. I was going to hold off on this quote, but I'll say it now. Here's DeYoung in his last sermon on Ecclesiastes, kind of bringing it all together. DeYoung, solid, conservative, Presbyterian brother. Okay? He's straight line, and I love so much of what he says and where he falls down. But I disagree with his view. He says of the writer of Ecclesiastes, that is, the writer of the body of Ecclesiastes, many people, and at least one of you asked this question, what I mean by the frame narrator. It could be that the same person, Koheleth, that's the title that's given, it's a feminine title in Hebrew, a feminine participle, but all trades are always listed in feminine. So you've heard of ekklesia, if you've taken Greek, or ekklesia, Ecclesiastes. Ekklesia is the church. Ecclesiastes is the Greek term applied to this book, translating koheleth, which comes from the verb, Hebrew verb kahal, which means to assemble. Koheleth is the feminine participle form, meaning one who assembles. And it doesn't mean that it's a woman in the book. It's the title of an occupation. He's the assembler, probably meaning his occupation is the one who gathers those like you to listen to his wisdom. So here's a man at the end of his life, and he's tagged the assembler. Well, this is what, and the book opens by telling us the words that we're going to listen to are the words of Koheleth. The words of Koheleth, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So it could be that Koheleth himself writes about himself in third person. The frame has Koheleth in third person, meaning talking about him. But then the body, the bulk of the 12 chapters, are the very words of this Koheleth, preacher, assembler, teacher. So, by frame narrator, we mean there's bookends that put Koheleth in third person, telling us about what he said, and that what either is about to be told or what was just said came from him, Koheleth. And so some people view automatically two different authors, as it were. The body of the material, that's the wisdom sayings, and then the frame, which includes the conclusion and the statement as to how we're to view Koheleth's words. Are they wise or are they foolish? And so you've got the frame and then the body, and here is Pastor Kevin. This preacher, he is searching, confused, contradictory, cynical, and his conclusion is very clear. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Life under the sun is purposeless, meaningless, empty, and pointless. Koheleth is a tricky figure to understand. Here is someone who is just frankly confused. He gets some stuff right. He also gets some stuff wrong. He has strengths and he has weaknesses. Good at seeing through the superficialities of life. Good at seeing the vanity and contradictions of our existence, but very bad at finding meaning and redemption. So you've got a solid evangelical brother who has vast influence, who has embraced the views of Tremper Longman, which are highly influential, that This is more like the wisdom of Job's three friends and not the wisdom that we should be following. When you preach this, you need to be thinking, this is more like Job's three friends. Don't listen to it. God said Job's three friends spoke wrongly about God. So if we can have all those chapters in Job that are a wrong view of God, isn't it possible that we have 12 chapters in Ecclesiastes, ultimately the entire book, that's designed to say what not to think rather than what to think? Then on the flip side, you've got folks like DeRoshi, Graham Ogden, Ardell Kanaday, Robert McCain, who have in print argued that no, he is not a fool. He's actually talking about real life, the world you and I live in. And when Paul says, Matoiates, the whole world was subjected to that, he has the world, that's the term that's used in the Greek text to translate hevel, and it's the same term in Romans 8:20. The whole world was subjected to enigmatic frustration in hope. That all the chaos, all the brokenness would ultimately be overcome and transformed. How? Through the offspring of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. But he's talking about our life. And the point is not all is hevel except for if you believe in God. He doesn't say that. He believes in God. He has a massively high view of God. In fact, God's going to control all things on this planet, both the good and the evil. It's a massive view of God's sovereignty. He is a believer rather than a non-believer, and it's this believer that is asserting all things are hevel. And that's why I don't think we can say all things are hevel without God, because he's affirming God and still declaring all things to be hevel. So there are entire commentaries that have been written saying, yes, everything is hevel unless you believe in God. But I think that actually contradicts what his point is. You believe in God, you live under the sun, and in that world of believing in God, everything is hevel. And it's because everything is hevel that I struggle to think that all the 30 instances of hevel within the body, add 8 more when you count the frame, that the varied instances of hevel are that we can translate them in different ways depending on the context. Well, sometimes it means meaningless, sometimes it means futile, pointless, sometimes it means fleeting or temporary. Other times, yeah, it probably means mysterious or enigmatic. But I struggle to think that we can use those different meanings in different contexts because within the declaration, the motto that frames the entire book, all is hevel. It's as if everything you see, everything you touch, everything you perceive, anything you know is hevel. So there's no other book that includes a key term, no other biblical book that includes a key term like this in such a pervasive way. So if we get the meaning of the term wrong, we'll probably get the meaning of the book wrong. So it is a distinct kind of wisdom. It's a unique way of wrestling. And what we have here seems to be an individual who has lived through life and experienced a lot of foolishness. And he is now wanting to, in the light of all the lessons he's gained, pass on what is true. And it's within this framework that you'll recall the chronicler not writing directly after Kings, but writing at the very end of the Old Testament age, Kings portraying, answering the question in the midst of exile, why are we here? Has God left us? No, you left him, and he's justly judged you. Chronicles is so different. Kings focuses on the north and the south. All these sins, chroniclers, the chronicles, focus on Jerusalem in the south and paints this beautiful picture, not perfect, but beautiful picture of hope when you look to the past. And one of the things it does is it never tells us about David and Bathsheba. Jumps over that story. And it never tells us about Solomon's idolatry. It emphasizes his wisdom and then lets him die honoring the Lord. And it suggests to me that indeed Solomon is one who, even though Kings doesn't tell us about it, the chronicler is giving accurate history when he allows Solomon to die a man of wisdom rather than covered in decades of foolishness, suggesting to me that the historical tradition that identifies Ecclesiastes with Solomon, this book fits a man who has been awakened to his own failures and foolishnesses. And when we go through Song of Songs next week, you're going to see that's my perspective there as well. I don't think Solomon is the beloved who really understands. Just look at me. I'm the model of impeccable, loving virtue to my woman. I don't think that's it. I think he's the third character. He's the one against whom the whole book is a foil, and he wrote the book in that way. There's a woman, and there's a man, and then there's Solomon. And Solomon has seen something that he never experienced, and he wants the young to read about it. This was love, a love I never experienced. Similarly, in Ecclesiastes, at the end of his life, writing as a truly godly realist about where all of his pursuits took him, the wisdom he gained, and through often a life of foolishness, and he wants us to hear what he's learned and the wrestlings he's had. That's how I'm understanding Ecclesiastes to fit. So, there's lots of things that don't make sense in this world. I think this book is going to say, in fact, there is nothing in this world that we fully comprehend in relation to God's purposes. We might get half a dozen of the reasons why God has operated the way he has, but there are thousands of other reasons that we don't ever understand. I'm going to open our time in prayer now. And one of the things I'm going to pray about is a specific situation in Chad, Northern Africa. The elections just happened. The ruler who's been on the throne for some time won the election, and then he was assassinated, it appears, by his son in his late 30s. His son totally dismantled all the government and has reorganized a new government. All the while, there is radical Muslim militia who have entered into the country and they're trying to overcome the government. And we have Southern Baptist missionaries not only there, but we also have the cluster leader who's over all the desert peoples is now a friend and having to figure out What does wisdom look like? Sometimes Paul fled, other times Paul stayed. And there's many who need wisdom in this moment of chaos. So let's pray. Father, I thank you that you are all wise and that you have purposed to be for your children. We ask that you would grant wisdom. There's no gain in this life, says the preacher. But there is more gain in wisdom than in foolishness. I pray that you would give hope and help. I thank you that in Christ we can be certain that come what may, it will work out for our deliverance, whether for through life or through death. So we ask that you would let those serving in the ground, many more even beyond the IMB in North Africa right now, that those serving in the ground would know the hope that is Jesus, and that you would guide them. We ask that you'd preserve their lives, preserve their ministries. They have opportunities at key points to flee when those that they're seeking to serve cannot flee at all. And so they need wisdom to know whether it's better to stay, even suffer for the sake of the name, or to get out of there. Thank you that you are our hope and that wisdom can take different forms at different times. Grant them peace, the support they need. Thank you that you are faithful. And meet us now as we look at this book. Help us understand your ways. There are many questions that these students have raised that they never pondered before. It's part of the purpose of a course like this. I pray that they would be gaining a foundation, not just storing up information that they've read or listened to, but an ability to not only observe carefully, understand rightly, but to evaluate fairly, lead them in paths of righteousness and unto truth. Your word is truth. Help us and meet us today. For the days of darkness are many. For some in this room, they are now, and they need hope. We need hope. Pray that your word would speak. An ancient word into a modern world. Cross the bridge into our hearts. In your name I ask. Amen. One of the principles that we found in the book of Proverbs and in the book of Job is that you sow what you sow, you reap, but that when you reap it is not necessarily now. That we need to have a broader vision of retribution theology. It doesn't always hold true in this life, and yet we rest confident that God will indeed make all things right in the end. Here's the wording of Ecclesiastes 8:14. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. So how is one to respond when the righteous get what the wicked deserve and the wicked get what it seems the righteous deserve? They're honoring the Lord and experiencing deep suffering. They're rebelling against God and experiencing what seems to be a life of ease. These are the types of dilemmas that the writer of Ecclesiastes, real life dilemmas that the writer of Ecclesiastes is wrestling with and wanting to guide younger listeners, less equipped listeners to properly face. When life feels like we're trying to shepherd the wind, and I can't get my hands around it, what do we do? How do we respond? Where do we go? And what's fascinating in this book is that right alongside the seven times of the root ra'ah being used for a shepherding of wind, everything is hevel, a shepherding of wind. And a shepherding of wind gives greater clarity to the meaning of hevel. It's used in apposition. The only other time the root to shepherd shows up is at the end of the book, in relation to the one shepherd from whom all wisdom comes. When life is like shepherding wind to us, fear the one shepherd. He'll carry you through. So Koheleth, as I said, is a title, an official title for a vocation. He's called the assembler. And it's what we read in chapter 1, verse 1. The ESV renders it preacher. The NIV renders it teacher. And it rightly gets the idea. There's times where in preparation we might preach to ourselves in the bathroom mirror, before the bathroom mirror, but the purpose is that we would have an assembly and proclaim the truths. So the two voices, Koheleth and the narrator, and they might even be the same person. I'm not against that at all. That Solomon would write about himself in, as he's putting it all into book form, write about himself or someone after Solomon reflecting on him. I'm going to do a little bit arguing for Solomonic authorship of this book, even though most evangelicals have given it up, because the principal reason, the language. The language of Ecclesiastes is unlike the Hebrew language anywhere else in Scripture. It's filled with numerous Aramaisms. Aramaic is a sister language to Hebrew. It uses the exact same script, a square Aramaic script. And Aramaic was the common language, just like English. English is the common language of the world today. Aramaic was the common language in the post-exile period. So I'm editing, or I just completed the editing of a massive 700-page commentary on Ecclesiastes for a Zondervan exegetical commentary in the Old Testament. Editing is not authoring. I'm on the editorial team, and so there's this other scholar, and he wrote this big book, and he professes to be an evangelical, but thinks that he has very alternative views that are non-traditional within evangelical camps, like that Ecclesiastes is the oldest book ever written in the Old Testament, that even though the Jews say that Malachi was the last prophet, he places this book 200 years after Malachi. And even though the Dead Sea Scrolls have copies of Ecclesiastes, he thinks that's quite amazing, and because they must have it almost straight from the pen of the preacher. And he thinks that the Solomonic persona is a joke. And that this was a person who got up dressed like Solomon. Everybody looked at him, knew that he wasn't Solomon, and he was dressed like Solomon, and he wrote a book that was actually quite humorous. designed to confront the political system of the day under the sun. And he used sun under the sun to be a cipher for underneath Ptolemaic Egyptian rule. So the sun is the Egyptian king. And under the sun is to live underneath the Egyptian king's rule. And in the midst of the terror of a hard-handed dictator, how should the people respond? And so I don't need to go into much more. I think his views are not faithful to the text. And his distancing from Solomon, I think, doesn't allow the text to speak as it calls us to read it. But many evangelicals, because of the difference of Hebrew, have even given up on Solomonic authorship, and they talk about a Solomonic persona. But to me, the language of the narrator and the language of the preacher, the way that both talk about the person who's talking, it doesn't suggest to me a literary figurative persona, but an actual one. One in which there is wisdom coming from him because of what he experienced as a king, a son of David, who went the wrong way and pursued things that within Scripture, the only king that we see doing it at this level is Solomon himself. So we enter into this book. Up on the screen, you see the basic structure. This is highly contested. Most commentaries just view that they don't even have this much of a structure. It's just random. Here's this topic, this topic, this topic, and it's all just thrown together. And but I do see there's this framing that takes place, a bookending that takes place. The motto occurs up front. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's 1 verse 2. And then in chapter 12, verse 8, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So that statement, that motto that colors the entire book, everything is hevel, frames. And then what comes next is a poem. And there's a poem on both ends of the book. An introductory and concluding poem. The introductory poem focuses on the cyclic nature of life and generation after generation, the forgetfulness of humans to their inability to learn from the past. So that such that even though we might be able to anticipate what's coming next, we are ignorant of what's coming next. But the patterns of life continue, cycle after cycle, generation after generation. The ending poem? So what do we do in such a world? We pursue joy. And how do we do it? In a world that makes little sense and that is filled with darkness. So that's the frame. And then in the body, you've got these two groups of wrestlings. There seems to be transition at 6:10, a movement from investigation to conclusion. We're going to walk through the book now. So the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So he notes that he's king of Jerusalem. And in verse 12 of chapter 1, he's king over Israel. This suggests a united kingdom rather than a divided kingdom. That too points to Solomonic authorship. But he's the son of David, and the only son of David who ruled over a united kingdom is Solomon. He's king in Jerusalem, and the words that we're reading are his words. Consider verse 16, chapter 1. I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Some people will say that's a little strange. If the only one in Jerusalem before him was David, why would he word it that way? This can't be Solomon. But we know there was a long line of kings in Jerusalem before David. They just weren't Jewish. Melchizedek was there. But not only that, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. Greater wisdom than David, greater wisdom than Melchizedek, and then there's a possibility that Jerusalem should be read even broader to other royal figures, not directly associated with Jerusalem, but that Jerusalem represents. Abraham's wife's name was Princess. In Genesis, even the Septuagint translator gives him the title Prince. Kings would come from him as if he's the first in a dynasty. Moses rises. He's portrayed as a leader of the people. Indeed, he'll even stand as God to Pharaoh, having massive authority, leading an entire kingdom, representing God before nations. I don't know if they're supposed to be brought into the Jerusalem figure, but Solomon, if this is him, he would be identifying that his wisdom surpassed all others. Consider verse 6 of chapter 2, actually verse 4. I made great works, built houses, planted vineyards for myself, made myself gardens and parks, planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had gone before me in Jerusalem. I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, many concubines, the delight of the children of man. I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I gained it. The depiction here is so much like the depiction of Solomon in the book of Kings. It's why throughout millennia, people have attributed this book to this man. He is the man of wisdom par excellence in the Old Testament. And yet he's a man whom we see entered into deep foolishness. And yet his words, take the book of Proverbs, are still canonical, authoritative, bound up in our scriptures, and not like Job's three friends. They are the very words of God. Not words that we're supposed to stay away from. Solomon's wisdom is not the wisdom of a pagan, unregenerate apostate. They are the words of a regenerated man who did not fall away forever, but whom God captured after he fell. We don't read about that capturing, but the way that Chronicles portrays him dying as a God follower, never hinting at rebellion, gives me clarity as to why Ecclesiastes could be from Solomon and show up in our Bibles. So the prologue to me points to Solomonic authorship. He is the most likely human author of the book. And it seems to me, when Jesus says someone greater than Solomon is here, he's building off a book like Ecclesiastes. So the nature of his queries, we enter in. The indicative motto, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, translates the ESV. 38 times in the book, at base, hevel means breath, a wisp of air. It's the name of Adam and Eve's first son, Abel, whose very life is a picture of what this book is wrestling with. Like, I don't understand why he was the one who honored God and his brother knocks him off. That doesn't make sense of reality, of who you are. You are all good, meaning you hate evil. You're all powerful, meaning you can stop evil. And yet the world is filled with things that don't make sense and go absolutely opposite of what I expect. Frustratingly enigmatic. What do I do, God? I can't put it all together. That's Abel. That's his life. Having eyes to see the bigness and beauty of God and yet experiencing the deepest level of suffering culminating in his own martyrdom. We'll come back to this, but you've got negative views of Hevel, meaningless. That's what it means to be breath in this book. It's empty. There's nothing there, no substance to this world. Everything in this world is just empty and pointless or absurd, meaning mentally irrational. It's actually counter logic, everything in this world. That would be the negative view, taking the idea of breath to mean there's no content there, no substance there. It's pointless, absurd, futile, vanity, meaningless. But that's not the only thing that Hevel could mean. It could mean a wisp of air, like it blows by me very quickly. This life is fleeting, temporary. Or, finally, the last major proposal is that by its breathiness, it's that I can't put my hands around it. I can't hold it. I can't grab it. I can't control it. It's beyond me. Unsearchable. Inscrutable. God's purposes. So there's lots of things that are tagged Hevel in this book. Toil and what comes of it, pleasure, wisdom and growing wise, words, Hevel. Living beings and times in their lives are Hevel. How God works things out in his justice is Hevel. Indeed, everything is Hevel. Everything. And as I said, the breadth of that statement, all is Hevel, calls me to want to see some common link beyond just the base meaning of breath, a common link as to breath in what way for everything in this world. In a world where God is actually affirmed rather than denied. That's the world of Koheleth. A world where he calls people to fear God rather than don't fear God. Go your own way. That's not his words. Fear God, all is Hevel. And both have to exist side by side. So we'll come back to what's going on there. But it does seem to me that Paul in Romans 8, 20 and 21, when he says this, for the creation was subjected to mateates, frustration, futility. That's how the ESV and NIV translate it. Mateates is the Greek term that renders hevel all throughout Ecclesiastes. The world was subjected to this. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Satan did not subject the world to frustration in hope. Human sin did not subject the world to frustration in hope. God alone subjected the world to frustration in hope, where that ultimate end could be tagged on next to that verb. So there is a purpose to hevel in God's mind. So that this isn't a random way to rule his world. He's creating the world this way for an ultimate purpose, and it relates to in hope, according to Paul. What I'm suggesting is that rather than denying what the preacher is saying about the world, Paul affirms what the preacher is saying about the world. And yet both he and the preacher recognize it's not the ultimate end. The introductory poem. Let's walk through this. There is a cyclical nature to all the world, including mankind's ignorance. So what do we see? First, there's no gain in this life. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and they go, no gain, no gain. A generation goes and a generation comes, but there is a constancy, and that is the earth. People die, the earth continues. There is a stability to the patterns of creation, verses 4 through 7. The earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down. It hastens to the place where it rises again. The wind blows to the south, it goes to the north. Around and around goes the wind. On its circuits, the wind returns. You and I can't grasp it, but it blows nonetheless. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, where they flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. In the midst of the constancy of the earth, mankind is never satisfied. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear ever filled with hearing. Yet in the midst of such a world, there is nothing new under the sun. What has been will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. So there's this generational cycle. The world is operating as it always has been. Same patterns are consistent, same structures in place. But a generation comes and a generation goes, and the new generation doesn't learn from the past. Verse 10, is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It's been already in the ages before us, yet there is no remember of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of it, of later things yet to be among those who come after. So it sets us up. We've got ignorance and constancy. All of it being overseen by this title, everything is hevel. The ignorance is hevel, the constancies are hevel from generation to generation. We begin. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under the sun. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So he's looking out over the world, God's in charge, and he's appointed a purpose for humanity. And it's an unhappy journey. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all of it is Hevel, a shepherding of wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. Everything is Hevel. Everything is a shepherding of wind. The ESV has striving after wind. It's a good image. You're trying to go for it, and yet it still raises the question, is it that you're striving in emptiness? Like it's a futile attempt. There's nothing there that you're actually pursuing. Or is it you're trying to get control of it and it's impossible to control? Chapter 2, 11 through 14. I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it. All was Hevel and thoughts of wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. This is significant. Under the sun is where he lives. In this sphere, there is no gain. A generation comes, a generation goes. All of our lives are going to end in the grave. No gain. No gain. You can't take the U-Haul with you behind the hearse. No gain. Yet he keeps going. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what's been done. I've done it all. It can only be repeated. I've had everything in this life, he says. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly. So here's where someone like DeYoung would say, look it. He is contradictory. I say, I don't think so. Notice the qualifier in verse 11. There is nothing to be gained under the sun. What about the day when there is no sun? There is more gain in wisdom than in folly, but not under the sun. But there is gain in this world. But it's not a gain that relates to this period under the sun. So when does it relate? It must have to do with the age after the sun. It's the only context for gain, living in the light of eternity. Take eternity away, no gain. But it's not gain for this life. There is more gain in wisdom than in folly, just as there is more gain in light than in darkness. Under the sun, that's where the light is, there's no gain. Verse 11. But there is gain in light. What's he talking about? Notice what he says next. There's more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I perceived that under the sun, the same thing happens to both of them. So let's step back and consider. Everyone is in this world is living under the sun. But according to this book, this is how he's going to talk about it. Not everyone sees the sun. Indeed, most of the world is living in darkness, even though they're under the sun. And there's no gain for anyone, believer or non-believer alike, under the sun. But there is more gain in wisdom. And there is a true gain if you have eyes to see light. So there's people who are living in darkness 24/7, even though the sun does appear. They don't see it. This is using light and darkness metaphorically. spiritually, about spiritual disability and spiritual ability. Do you have eyes to see? But it, as we're going to note, it does not mean that those who have eyes to see light always see light. Indeed, the days of darkness will be many for believer and non-believer alike. But for the non-believer, they are all darkness because they don't have eyes in their head. The wise person has eyes to see light in this world under the sun. The sun rises, the sun sets. There are seasons where we see the goodness and the blessing of God, the provision of God, and then the sun goes down, and we have to live in hope. Chapter 3, verse 1. What is this world? Everything, for everything, there's a season, a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. There is a time to kill, just not a time to murder. Not all killing is murder. There's a time to heal. There's a time to break down, a time to build up, to weep, but also a time to laugh. There's a time to mourn and a time to dance. This book is giving freedom. In all the crookedness, notice chapter 1, verse 15. In all the crookedness of this world, there is still time to dance. There is still time to laugh, to plant, to heal. There's still time for that. I've had 1 week in my life where four friends or relatives died in a single 7 days. It was a Friday morning when I heard, sitting during my devotions, of my fourth friend's death. It was a 33-year-old, beautiful woman who lost her battle with cancer and left my good friend's bed empty. And that morning was my oldest daughter's 16th birthday. And Daddy was supposed to take her out for her birthday breakfast. As shepherds, as Christians, we have to gain a framework for figuring out when the days of darkness are many and it's your fourth death in a week, how you can truly rejoice in your 16th daughter's birthday with genuine delight, all the while grieving deeply over the loss that's come to your friend. This is a book that helps you figure out how to do that. It's a real life book that's facing the tragedies and the joys. I'm going to not use that word. The tragedies and the bounty. And I'm not using that word because in this book, joy is supposed to be constant. It's not related to circumstance. We're going to see that in this book. Absolutely. This book identifies that grief is a part of the human experience that God created. That there is a place to grieve that is not cursing God, but grieving over deep loss, grieving over real pain. There's a time to mourn, to weep with those who weep, to celebrate with those who celebrate. Absolutely. There's a time to cast away stones and a time to gather them together. You're clearing the garden. You're building the house. There's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Time to seek and a time to lose. Time to keep and a time to cast away. To tear and to sow. To keep silence and to speak. To love, to hate. There is a time for war and there is a time for peace. So we now consider, in the midst of this world of polar realities, what gain is there for all of my efforts, for all of my toil? We already learned in verse 11 of chapter 2, no gain under the sun. Verse 13, more gain in wisdom than in foolishness. What gain is there for the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. Not the business, not the busyness. What God's given to humans in this cursed world. He has made everything beautiful in its time. A time to war, beautiful. A time for peace, beautiful. A time to love, beautiful. A time to hate, beautiful. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Sexual desire, yes, beautiful in its time. He's put eternity in the heart of man. He's put forever in the heart of man. I think it's talking about the capacity to connect with that which is eternal. It's part of imageness, being made in the image of God. A capacity to identify with that which is eternal, to embrace, to display, to engage. And yet, God has done what he has done, putting eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Ignorance. It's part of God's purpose. A capacity to know God, and yet an inability to fully grasp God. I perceive that there is nothing better in such a context of ignorance, where beauty is governed by time. I perceive that there is nothing better than for them, that is mankind, to be joyful, to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is a gift of God. There's nothing better than to take pleasure in the work of your hands under the sun. Yet, what we're going to find is that this gift to man is not given to all men, only given to some. It's part of what is going to make the wrestling of Koheleth so frustrating and hard to grasp. Why there are elect and non-elect. Some who taste and see the goodness of God and others who don't. Some who spend their entire life seeking, seeking, and never finding, and others who seek and find. If you are granted the gift of delighting, embrace it. When God gives you the chance to simply enjoy a Chipotle burrito, take it. Because the opportunity won't always be there. If you have a chance to go on vacation and let your spouse, your children, experience something awesome in God's world, take it. Yet the balance of this is going to be doing always, knowing that God will hold you account for the choices you make. We're getting there. It will come. But this vision of seize the day is, I believe, a godly one when understood, when engaged in the sight of God. The point is, if your parents gave you the gift that you were longing for, you are not honoring them if you set it aside and say, I just want you. No, delight in the bike. Get that G.I. Joe set and just play with it all day long. In doing so, you're honoring dad and mom. You're honoring the giver. And if he gives you that opportunity, the power to delight in his gifts, this book is saying embrace them, because the days of darkness will be many. When you'll be called upon to recall those moments of peace. And those moments of peace will supply fuel for you to endure to the next moment of peace. We're getting there. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them. There's many with wealth and possessions with no power to enjoy. Ever craving, ever longing, never satisfied. But if you were given the power to just delight, nurture that contentment in the gifts of God, embrace it. Everyone to whom is given the ability to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, know this, this is a gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart. So I want you, we're going to consider this, but notice the logic. Delighting in what God has supplied, remembering it, keeping it in mind and letting it delight your soul, all the provisions that he has made, provides you fuel for actually forgetting, in this instance, what it says, he won't much remember the days of his life. Why that's significant, we're going to see in chapter 11. Because the days that you're not remembering are mostly dark days, where even though you had eyes in your head, it was as dark as could be and you could see no light. So there is something, there's a gift that's being given to those who God's provided for you something. And in the moments of that provision, receiving the gift to delight in it is actually going to be a benchmark point in your pursuit of God, so that when the darkness comes, you look backwards. Philippians chapter 4. Darkness has come. Don't be anxious about anything. But in everything, oh yes, you're going to pray. You're going to make supplication with thanksgiving. And as you do, the peace of God will come, such that when you reach glory, what you're going to remember is the faithfulness of God and not the pains you endured. I think that's what he is suggesting. There is an evil. Notice what we read next. There is an evil. Is that meaningless? Without substance? No, there is evil. That's giving content to this life. There is an evil that happens in this world. that I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind, that a man to whom God gives the wealth and the possessions and the honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger ends up enjoying them. This is hevel. It's a grievous evil. Evil, shorthand for curse. Curse that's not overcome. It's part of this broken, crooked world. So at the end of chapter 5, you've got those who have the wealth and the possessions and the power to enjoy them. And then in the beginning of chapter 6, those who have the wealth and the possessions and no power to enjoy. Ever craving, ever longing, ever looking and seeking to fill their emptiness with that which is empty. And so they just continue to be empty. What you revere, you will resemble, whether for restoration or for ruin. You go after emptiness, you will become empty. You live in the darkness, it's all that you will ever experience. And it's grave as the preacher considers such things.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. For more writings, sermons, and lectures from Dr. DeRoshi, please visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.